Praveen Mohan is known worldwide for his research into the symbology of ancient temples around the world. His archaeological and spiritual quest has taken him to Peru and Indonesia, but focuses chiefly on the ancient treasures to be found in India. He has guested on History Channel's Ancient Aliens and has built his own platform to some 4 million subscribers across 4 languages. Praveen Mohan, welcome to The Fifth Kind.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you with us today. I love your documentaries, and it's a real treat to be shown around places that most people will never get the opportunity of visiting. I was very fortunate to visit India some years ago and explore some of the temples, but you take us to some very interesting places. And on those journeys, you found suggestions of ancient technology, healing therapies, ancient knowledge of medicine, genetics, possible contact with other species, and hints of international and global culture from the deep past that seems to throw a question mark over what we think we know about history. We're going to touch on all of those things in our conversation today, but I thought it'd be interesting to start by asking you, what got you started? What was the thing that drew you into this fascinating field?
Well, the thing is, I had a very unique childhood. When I was a child, I grew up around temples, not just one temple. I grew up in multiple temples. So it was really a unique experience because I was 10 years old and I would be inside the temple for more than 6 hours every day. And I used to look at all the idols and statues. And you know, the Hindu temples in India, they have hundreds of stone statues. So I would look at the statues. I would try to understand why they are carved in a certain way. And I distinctly remember one time there was a giant granite pillar lying on the floor. And it had an unfinished carving. It was a lingam and it was an unfinished carving. And I was only about 10 years old. So I thought I would go and finish the carving myself. So the next day I went back to the temple with an iron nail, thinking that I could just somehow finish the carving. And I realized I couldn't do it. The next day I went with a screwdriver, hoping that, you know, I could somehow use it as a chisel. And I realized that that didn't do it either. So after trying for about 2 weeks, I convinced myself it's not because I couldn't do it. It's because of the fact that the pillar was on the floor, right? So I thought maybe if I could put it up erect, I could finish the carving. So I couldn't move the pillar. After trying, I gave up. So I went back to school. I got a bunch of my friends who were all 10-year-olds. And then we tried to basically prop the pillar up, erect. And we realized how heavy it was. And as a young boy, I realized that, so what appears to be so simple is actually extremely complex. I'm not able to carve anything on this granite pillar, because granite is a very hard material. It's one of the hardest rocks in the world. And we also realized that if 10 boys could not move this pillar must be weighing in tons. It's not in kilograms or pounds. This pillar is weighing in tons. And then we started wondering, how did ancient builders cut these rocks from the quarries? How did they move these pillars to the temple site? And how did they carve on these granite rocks, right? It's not really that simple. And what we read in history books is that, okay, so people were using really primitive tools. They didn't even have hardened steel at that time, like the steel I was using, like the screwdriver I was using. So how did they carve these amazing things into these pillars? And how did they move these tons and tons of rocks? So I got exposed to this kind of idea very, very early in my childhood. And obviously that must have been sleeping inside for a very long time. And then maybe when I was like 25, it just, you know, something woke up that beast and I started to look at it again.
Oh, wonderful. Back when you were 10 and beginning to ask questions about what you're seeing in the temples, it sounds like you were in a very devout family to be in the temple sort of 6 days a week. Did you take your questions to your parents? Did they offer you any answers?
My parents simply dismissed these questions as just, you know, these are curious questions. He will get over it, right? That's what yes. people do to all the kids. Okay, he's just going through a phase. He will get over it, right? But yeah, I grew up in a family, in a Hindu family, which was really devout. So I had a chance to read all the ancient texts. So I read all the stories, and which is what really, you know, deepened my interest, right? Because the ancient texts of India talk about very advanced technology. They talk about flying machines or vimanas. They talk about test tube babies. They talk about genetic engineering. They talk about interstellar travel. They talk about time travel. So it's very interesting. I mean, I think I had a very interesting childhood.
So at the age of 25, did you already know that there were these anomalous pieces of advanced information about interstellar travel, time travel, or was 25 the beginning of your journey to discovering that there were all these treasures?
When I was 25, I was in the United States. I was at 25, I think I was in Boston at that time. And I actually started to travel a lot. Initially, I traveled to, you know, the fun places. You know, I would probably go to like Cancun in Mexico and spend a weekend there partying. But later on, I started to go to the Mayan pyramids of Mexico and I started to look at the structures. And then I went to Peru and I went to places like Machu Picchu and Ollantaytambo. And then I started to connect that with my childhood ideas and realize that, okay, this is a global phenomenon, right? We don't have these giant megalithic structures only in India. We also have them in Mexico. We also have them in Peru. We definitely have them in Egypt. So I started to put these things together and realize that, okay, so there is something that we are not addressing here. We don't understand that fully. And it's all around the world. So when I was in the US until 2015, I focused more on South America and Central America. I looked at all those structures, and we have these giant mounds in the United States. So I did some documentaries about the Serpent Mound and the Alligator Mound and things like that. But then as I started to delve deeper and deeper into these ancient sites, I realized that no, in order for me to crack this code, I have to come back to India. Because the most important detail, and I don't know if you know this, is that all the Greeks are not worshiping Thor or Hercules anymore. The Egyptians are not worshiping Ra, right? Those gods are all gone. I mean, they've become superheroes sometimes in the modern day movies. But in India, we have 1 billion people who are still worshiping the same gods. And so we have the continuity. So when we go to Greece or when we go to Egypt, we can't ask the locals, what does this mean? What does this god mean? What kind of rituals are associated with the statue? Because that tradition is gone. But in India, we still have these temples, and all the locals go to these temples and still do certain type of ritual for certain gods. So I realized that if I come back to India, I could not only research the temples, I could also understand what these statues mean and how these locals have these stories connected to them.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm going to come back to rituals in temples a little later. But before we get there, I just wanted to ask if you could give us a survey of some of the sort of anomalies that you can find in terms of out-of-place
artifacts,
technology. Yeah, out-of-place technology portrayed in temples. And you can find it all around the world, but I'm particularly interested in what you found in India.
Okay. So we have a particular type of artifacts called oop art. These are called out-of-place artifacts. The classic example of this is the Antikythera mechanism, where they found a weird mechanism, but it's much, much older. That kind of a gear mechanism is not supposed to exist like 2,000, 5,000 years ago. But they found it. So, but in India, we also find these out-of-place carvings. For example, in Hoysaleswara Temple, which is a 850-year-old temple, you have a person holding up a telescope to one eye, closing the other eye, and looking at the sky. Such a carving is not supposed to exist because the telescope was invented much later than, you know, when the temple was built. It was the telescope was invented by Lippershey and Galileo much later. So we are not supposed to find carvings of a telescope. And then in Konark Sun Temple, you have a carving of a giraffe. And we see a bunch of people hanging out with the giraffe. And giraffes are only found in Africa. And we're not even talking about North Africa, like Egypt or something like that. We're talking about deep down in the south. So, but we do find carvings of the giraffe in India. So we have evidence of advanced civilizations around the world, which are somehow connected, and we're not able to put them together. In Hoysaleswara Temple, you have a carving of an Egyptian. It looks very much like an Egyptian. In another temple called the Brihadeeswara Temple, you have a carving of a European, okay, with a top hat. So all these evidences prove that, you know, we're not fully understanding these things, and these don't fit into the traditional history books, and these are all out-of-place artifacts. But the most important part about the technology is that we have evidence of these vimanas or flying machines. We do see that they have these vimanas carved in ancient temples. Now, what does a vimana mean, right? A vimana is a flying machine very similar to an airplane, okay? And then there is also another vimana, which is very similar to a rocket or like a thing for space travel. Those are also called vimanas. The most popular one, which all Indians know about, is called a Pushpaka Vimana. This is mentioned in the ancient text called Ramayana, which is more than 2,000 years ago. And it clearly says that, okay, so there is a person who takes another person from India and he takes that person to Sri Lanka. Okay, this is through flight. So they're basically flying in air, and they even mention how they contact a bird in between when they fly. So this is very similar to how we travel to Sri Lanka. For example, I can travel from India to Sri Lanka in an hour. Like I would just go to the airport, take a flight and go there. So this kind of technology is mentioned clearly in ancient texts, and you can see them carved in ancient Indian temples. So you can actually see these carvings, which look like a small aircraft, looks very much like a microlight or an ultralight people fly today, and they're shown with wings. Sometimes they're shown with like strange accessories attached to them. Okay, so we can see evidence of these flying machines. And it's really interesting how our perspective is slowly changing, because just 100 years ago, before the Wright brothers came in, people used to think that this is absolute nonsense, right? This is pure fantasy. How can something that's heavier than air fly in air, right? So people, especially Westerners who studied the Vimana and translated them into English, they said this was pure fiction. There's no such technology. This is all coming out of pure imagination. And in the last 100 years, people have started to question, is it possible that they had this kind of technology thousands of years ago? Now,
yes,
there's one more type of Vimana mentioned in ancient Indian texts, and this is even better, right? Because they're talking about interstellar travel. The texts often mention how the gods come from the sky using Vimanas. And just 2 decades ago, right, 20 years ago, before Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos started thinking about going to Mars and terraforming that place and start to colonize Mars for us to go and live there, people, again, thought this is just complete fiction. They just couldn't imagine that. But today, Elon Musk is planning to go to Mars. He's going to alter the surface of Mars. He's going to alter the atmosphere, right, for making it usable by humans, right? This is called terraforming, right? But the same technology is mentioned in ancient Indian texts. In Ramayana, there is a person called Trishanku, okay? So for this person, there were some people who went to another planet and created that planet suitable for him to go there and live. And again, you know, the text mentions that they went in a golden Vimana to that planet. So they were not only talking about the flying Vimanas and interstellar travel, but they were also talking about these advanced concepts like terraforming.
Yes. This is very interesting because there's quite a difference between how these accounts in the Vedas have been treated in India with how accounts of ancient technology have been treated in the Bible. And in my research, I've found lots of references to flying technology and interstellar technology in the Bible. But through the centuries before flight and our journeys into space, the translators tried to translate them as spiritual phenomena and didn't look on them as technology. Whereas with the Vedas, it's always been understood this was the flying technology of the gods, but it was disbelieved. When I went to India, I didn't know anything about the Vedas, but I could see the carvings on the buildings and I could see things that looked like turbines, that looked like jet engines, that looked like rockets, that looked like aircraft. And so I was full of questions. As a young boy traveling around India. Now I've seen more than that. I've seen tablets that look like, you know, iPads or iPhones, medical devices, guns, bombs. When you ask the mainstream commentators about these devices now that we have this technology, is there more openness to the idea that the Vedas are describing real historical experiences and that these carvings are portraying things that were real material science in the deep past?
There's going to be a lot of reluctance and resistance from mainstream historians and archaeologists. Understandably so, right? Because they have studied their own materials and they had to get all their degrees and their masters and their doctorates reading the materials, right? Saying repeatedly, pounding into their heads, saying that, okay, so these temples were built with primitive technology. These things did not exist. Human beings evolved from apes. It was a very slow transition. We were all like primitive people until like 2,000, 3,000 years ago. So they've studied that from high school all the way up to their PhDs. And if they had to change their minds, I mean, what would happen to their jobs? So there's going to be a lot of resistance from them. We do see them Which is why I always take extra pains to, show the evidence as it is. There's still a lot of resistance, even when we show them, okay, so there is a carving that's holding something like a cell phone to its ear, right? So people, it's just there, whether you like it or not, that carving is still there in a 1,000-year-old temple. So, but people find it very hard to accept it because the evidence is right in your face. We don't know 100% if it's a cell phone, but that carving is there. Rather than accepting it that the statue exists, people try to discredit you, right? And I'm sure you face your own group of people who try to discredit you, because when we put out evidence that goes against centuries of established institution type stuff, we're going to get a lot of people who are upset. This is just the name of the game. But it's our duty to show the evidence.
When you show evidence like that, say the person using what looks like a cell phone, what's the usual response? Do the mainstream experts say, it looks like that, but it's something else? Do they say it's just imaginary technology? Do they tell you you're not seeing what you're seeing? What's the general approach?
We've seen a lot of different types of responses. In India, the responses tend to be more about your character rather than what the evidence is. It'd be simply like, oh, okay, Paul Wallace is not a good person. Type of stuff, rather than saying, okay, what he's showing is not right. So this is still the mentality in India. One great thing is that there are some people who look at the evidence and see it as evidence. We do still have at least like 1/3 of the population who look at that evidence. If a person is holding something like a telescope to his eye and closing the other eye and looking at the sky, what else could it be?
Yes.
Right? So we have about 1/3 of the people who actually say, okay, so this is real solid evidence. So it is possible that something like a telescope existed 900 years ago. That's the logical conclusion. But there's still like more than 50% of the people who, because see, it challenges what they've read for the last 25 to 50 years. That evidence is in your face, challenging whatever the ideas you have accumulated. Right. So it's very hard to face that kind of evidence because we all have confirmation bias. We'll just immediately switch over. You will either change the video, because if you do face that evidence, if you do face that reality, then you have to change your own reality, which you have built for such a long time.
You're absolutely right, Praveen. And I think it really is the role of the writer or the documentary maker to push the conversation forward, because peer review will always keep people conservative. If people want to keep their tenure, they're not going to be the ones bringing the radical new ideas, but at least the academics can discuss what this crazy Praveen Mohan has said or this crazy Paul Wallace has said, and then you can move the conversation a little bit. But at least with the examples of the carved heritage that you look at, you've got a lot of support for what those things are in texts. So you have ancient texts that talk about flying craft. You have ancient texts that talk about gestation pods or terraforming. So that when you come to the carvings, it's not something you've just plucked out of the air to say, oh, this looks like that. You are saying this looks like what we have described in the texts. And in modern language, we would call it this. We would call it in vitro fertilization. We would call this a gestation pod. We would call this a flying craft, whatever it is. We would call this a surgical procedure. So there is that support there that should make it easier for some to come into the conversation and then ask the next question, was it real?
Yeah, I certainly think so.
I want to suggest also, you've found such wonderful treasures in your documentaries, and not only have you found portrayals of technology, but you've found actual pieces of technology. And one that I really enjoyed hearing you explain was the name of the temple, I think, is Chandi Kimpulan. And you found the buried remains of a piece of technology that appears to be for the purpose of generating electricity. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So we went to Indonesia about 3 months ago, and we were in Indonesia. We were actually in Central Java for about 3 weeks, and we were analyzing a couple of temples there. One of them is a small, nice little Hindu temple, and it has a very interesting story behind it. Actually, there is this great university called the Islamic University of Indonesia, and 20 years ago, they were trying to build a new library, and they started, you know, the construction workers started to dig for a foundation. But surprisingly, they found something buried inside, and when they started to dig those things up, a Hindu temple started to come out. And archaeologists confirmed that this temple is about 1,200 years ago. So this is a very ancient temple. And the archaeology report gets very, very interesting. So they had things buried under the base of the lingam, and they also had things buried between the lingam and the base. Now, what's really interesting is that I looked at the archaeology report. I started to recreate what they found in the temple. So they would say, okay, we found pieces of silver here. So I would go and buy pieces of silver. And they said, okay, they found like golden foils there. So I actually went there and got golden foils and iron and copper and all that stuff. Now, it's very, very interesting to me because the archaeology report done by the government of Indonesia actually says, we found a copper wire. This is strange because you don't see this kind of evidence, you know, coming out of other places. But they have clearly said, this is a copper wire. I mean, what else do you use a copper wire for? This is for electricity. So I started to put those things together, and I recreated the whole setup. I built a small little lingam. I built a pot, and the same pot was found in Chandi Kimpulan, and they filled it with husk, which was used as a placeholder for things. In India, we still use it. In India, if we want something to be held in place, we put husk and we pour water on top of it. So because it just holds it in that place forever, nothing happens to it. I mean, think about it. It's really interesting, right? Husk is organic, right? Mm-hmm. But it's still intact for 1,200 years in Indonesia, buried, right? Nothing happened to it. So it's some really interesting material. So I started to put those things together, and I put a silver plate and an iron plate in that husk, and I put it in that pot, and I put it in front of the lingam, and I poured water on top of the lingam, just like what any Hindu would do, even today. This is an ongoing practice. We always pour water on top of the lingam. And when we checked it with a voltmeter, we realized that this produces electricity. You know, the ions move from one metal to another, and we are producing more than 0.5 volts of electricity. And it was really shocking to me. And then I realized that these ancient builders there were actually generating electricity, which is evident because I recreated the same setup, and they even had copper wires. But what did they use this electricity for? Were they lighting up light bulbs or like doing something else with it. But then I realized how Hindus do these rituals, right? They would put their hands in the pot, right? And then I started to go and read online about electrotherapy. It's very interesting because Benjamin Franklin, who is one of the founding fathers of the United States, also talks about a similar procedure. He called it the electric bath. So these people, again, use the same technology. They used two electrodes and they just sent some low volt or low amp electricity into the water. And humans were supposed to put their hands, or if you had, for example, if you had pain in your feet, you just put your feet in that bathtub, right? And this is exactly what ancient Hindus were doing 1,200 years ago. Now, we don't know if they fully understood this, by the way, right? But what would, even in India, this is very common. If you come to India, if somebody has this, let's say he had chronic hand pain, right? So instead of going to the doctor and taking all the pills and getting all the side effects and all that stuff, these people actually go to these temples and they pour water on the lingam and they put their hands in that pot, right? Actually getting electrotherapy. And the thing is, all these, like, for example, if you go to a doctor today, if you go to a physiotherapist, he would be like, okay, come for like 12 sessions, come for 25 sessions. Like, you have to come for the next 25 days and get electrotherapy. But ancient Hindus masked it in the name of rituals. They'd be like, okay, you cannot miss even one day. You have to come here for the next 40 days and put your hand in this pot to get the healing power of the lingam.
So this is absolutely fascinating. I've had electrotherapy myself. Anyone who's read my books knows about all my injuries. And I've been to physiotherapists and they've electrocuted different bits of me. And so I know this ritual from a Western perspective. This is what you do. We put this equipment on you. We'll just run it through you for the next 15 minutes. What's fascinating is that people had this pattern of going to temples. And I think very often we look at that pattern and we oversimplify what's happening. Oh, they're going to worship a deity. They're going to do some devotional act to a deity. But what you found there suggests they might be also going for healing rituals that they expect to be effective. Now, that whole scenario of the battery that you found, that didn't come together by accident. Somebody knew how to put that together. And I'm very intrigued. This date has come up a couple of times already in the conversation when you talk about the age of the temples, about 1,000 to 1,200 years ago. So at that time, it seems like somebody knew how to put one of those together that would have a healing effect. Even if they didn't have technological language for it, they knew how to construct it, and it was technology. So I've got a couple of questions here. People going to temples, are they going for lots of different things, including this kind of healing therapy? And where did the knowledge come from prior to 1,200 years ago?
Yeah, well, today people go to temples for a variety of reasons. A lot of people just go there as a part of their daily or weekly routine. There are many devout Hindus. Like I said, we got like 1 billion pagans, if you will. From the Western perspective, we got 1 billion pagans still left who are actively involved in all these rituals. There are a lot of sick people who are going to get healed. There are a lot of quote unquote, like kind of mentally sick, like they're depressed. They might maybe going through some problems and they're going to the temples. And they usually follow a ritual that'll be like, okay, so if you come here and then, you know, worship this deity for the next 40 days, you'll be healed, right? Well, I mean, sometimes it's just common sense. If the person is obese and they'd be like, okay, just go to this temple on top of the mountain every day, and then and then go around the temple for like nine times. I mean,
you'll notice the difference.
I think it's just it would probably what my fitness trainer would tell me, right? Just go on top of the mountain.
It makes sense.
Yeah, so a lot of this is also masked in the name of rituals, and it works better because even if your doctor tells you, you may skip a couple of sessions, but if you're really devout, you may not skip any session at all. So it works really well.
Yes.
So so people go to these temples for a lot of reasons. We have understood some parts of it. Some of this is pure superstition. And don't think I'm just masking everything, saying that, okay, everything that these people are doing is right. I'm not saying that. I'm not at all saying that. There's definitely some superstition there, which may have been added on later in the past few centuries. But there is a lot of rituals which are also there, which actually help us a lot. Yes. The real problem is to separate both of them because we don't understand which one is helpful and which one is harming us. And that's where we are. India is having a lot of these beliefs and things. We don't know like what is what. And a lot of it is mentioned in ancient texts. A lot of it is also not mentioned in ancient texts.
Yes.
So
there's tradition that isn't written down, but that has been maintained nevertheless for a long time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Lots of traditions are not written down and we follow them. I mean, weird traditions, like it just really strange. The thing is like, we're not supposed to cut down trees. You know, this is really weird. Like the thing is, trees are gods for us, actually. So we're not actually supposed to cut down trees. From face value, it just seems really simple. Like, we're not supposed to cut down trees. Like, how do you make all the furniture and stuff like that? But until the last 50 years ago, when people didn't do it, when people thought that, okay, so trees are gods, let's not harm the gods kind of things. India was much, much greener. You know, but once we got like quote unquote civilized and said, okay, these are just trees, let's cut them. The deforestation was just going insane. The amount of deforestation, the amount of trees, because people just became completely reckless, right? It must have been the belief that kept them on a leash because they just went completely nuts. And now the deforestation is just crazy. We lost a bunch of trees. We lost a significant portion of the trees in the last 50 years.
So it turns out there was a lot of sense in the ancient wisdom.
Yes.
And maybe the explanation had been short, but there was a lot of wisdom in it. I notice many of the temples you walk around, you are barefoot because they're considered sacred spaces. And then a couple I've noticed you wandering around in trainers. So what's happened to the temples where you're allowed to wear trainers? Are they not working temples anymore?
Yeah, so most of the times it's not something that's enforced by others. What I do is that when I go to a temple, I see if it is a living temple, meaning that is the main statue in the central chamber intact? Okay, if it's not intact, we don't have to, if it's destroyed, it's not a living temple. So I would probably put on my shoes and do all the research. Sometimes it's really hard. Most of the times I would remove my shoes. I'd like to do this almost in all temples, not to put my shoes on. Because I myself am a Hindu, I'm a devout Hindu, and we also have a lot of people who are watching who are also devout Hindus. We certainly don't want to hurt their sentiments, but sometimes the temples are, it's impossible not to wear shoes. A lot of people think, okay, go to Angkor Wat, but don't wear shoes. Angkor Wat is like three times the football field in the US, okay? It's bigger than the the Vatican City, I think. Okay, so I'm not going to be walking for like the whole day without shoes, okay? So sometimes we use common sense. Sometimes we have to go on top of the temples. We try to restore them. Sometimes there are thorns. Sometimes there are, you know, like places that you do have to wear shoes. You know, the authorities say, look, in Indonesia, sometimes the authorities will say, look, you have to wear shoes and only then we'll let you in, right? It's like yes, no shoes, yes. No service type of stuff.
Yes,
so sometimes
yes.
I do. Yeah, but mostly I don't like to put on my shoes, but if necessary, I will wear my shoes.
Yes. Something that crops up in sacred spaces around the world, cathedrals and temples alike, is cymatic patterns. And you can see them built into stained glass windows. You can see them designed as mandalas. And cymatic patterns, for anyone who doesn't know, are the patterns generated by sound waves. And you find them in Hindu temples. What is their meaning in that context? What is their function?
In ancient Hindu temples, in the ceilings, especially on top of the main deity, you'll see these large circular patterns, like elaborately carved with a variety of details. And each one is different. And I call them cymatic patterns. We don't actually have a real name for it. But the thing is, I think these are visual images of a certain sound. And we know that like everything that we talk about, like today we're talking and, you know, what we're basically doing is just throwing some sound and we're able to kind of translate that sound into meanings and then we're communicating between each other. But if we just take that pure sound and it can be represented visually and all the sounds that we say, all like the wind blowing or the mantras like Om that we use in Hinduism, everything comes to like a nice circular pattern with a lot of like designs inside. So we see these elaborate carvings and they look very similar. They look similar to propellers. They look similar to the Iron Man's arc reactor. But these are all cymatic patterns, but we're not able to reverse engineer that. We don't know what that visual we think that visual is a cymatic pattern of a specific sound, but we're not able to go back to that sound from that visual, okay? We're able to do the opposite. I myself have a, I forgot the name of it. I myself have a machine where we actually chant the mantras and it has like a, it's called a Kladni plate. That's what it's called. I have a plate and then I sprinkle some water, some salt on it. And then we chant the mantras in our group. And then we can see the cymatic patterns. Okay. So we're able to do the opposite. We're able to make these sounds and we're able to look at the visual representation of that sound. And now we have hooked it up to certain frequency devices and we put like a certain frequency and we're able to see how that frequency looks on the Kladni plate. But we're not able to do the opposite. We're not able to see, okay, so this cymatic pattern on the ceiling corresponds to this mantra or this sound. We're not there yet. But maybe in the next 10 to 20 years, we'll be able to reverse engineer that and say, okay, so this temple is dedicated to this mantra, which means this. And that temple is dedicated to this mantra, which means that. Okay. And in Hindu texts, this is what happens, right? So let's say you go there with like a chronic cold, they will give you a specific mantra to chant for a certain time. If you go there with depression, they'll give you a different mantra. Right? So I think I think these temples were built for specific reasons. I think, for example, the sick people would go to a certain temple. The people who had like broken relationships all the time, they should go to another temple, this kind of stuff. Because the temples had that essence of that mantra in them.
Yes. I'm really interested to see where that kind of research goes, because I believe there are many sacred spaces in the East and the West that were really places for sound healing. And the spaces had been designed to resonate at particular frequencies or particular kinds of healing experience. It's just a speculation on my part, but I have been to places where you walk into the space and you think, I just want to stay here. There's something about the energy in this room that I just want to sit in. I'm sure you've had that experience as well with all the temples that you visited.
Yes. One thing about the real ancient temples, when I mean ancient in India, I'm specifically talking about temples which are older than, let's say, about 600 years, you know. So if you go to those temples, it's very hard for you to hold a negative thought. I've experimented with this. You could be having a bad day. You could be upset about somebody or something. And then when you enter the temple, you're still holding it. But as you go towards the central chamber, it just leaves you completely. And you can spend like an hour or 2 hours inside the temple and you just completely forget that negative thought. It's very hard for you to go and sit in a temple and like plan a murder. Like it's just impossible. Because I think this is fascinating, because we don't understand how they achieved that. They yes. must have achieved that with something else. You don't have to be a Hindu. You don't even have to be a theist. You can be an atheist, right? Yes. You don't have to believe in God. And if you still walk through that ancient Hindu temple, the modern Hindu temples have just dropped that concept. They don't know why they're building it, right? The modern Hindu temples have completely like not understood that. But in ancient Hindu temples, they put certain materials. For example, the walls were usually made of granite, but the central statue was never made of granite, never. So and the walls and the outer chambers of the temple will have carvings and everything, but the inner chamber has nothing. It's just completely empty. And it's built of, and they built acoustics in a certain way. So as you're moving towards the central chamber, so you just slowly drop all your negative energy and you're going there, right? And they put a lot of things inside, and we have only understood some parts of this, because they would do these elaborate rituals, right? They put like a giant lingam made of like shiny black rock, which they go to like the river Ganga, which is like far away, and they get this piece of rock and they polish it. But before planting it in the ground, they would put like gold and silver and like all the diamonds and everything inside. So they must have tried to do something there, which we don't understand, right? But what we do understand is that it works. I don't know Yes. how it works. Right? I don't know how it works, but if you're having a bad day, if you are in India and if you had a bad day, you can just go to these ancient sites and you just forget about everything and like completely cleanse your mind of and get rid of all these negative thoughts. We know that it works, but we just don't know why it works or how it works.
Yes. I'm going to come back a little later to some of your spiritual experiences, which I'm very interested in. But before we get there, you mentioned earlier your trip to Indonesia, which is quite recent. And while you were there, you went to the Candi Suku Temple, which is an extraordinary place. And my jaw dropped when I saw you walk around this place, because it really is an anomaly. It portrays long-skulled people, such as you might find in ancient Peru, the Paracas skulls, or in Egypt with the way some of the pharaohs were portrayed. With the false beard that was Egyptian fashion as well. You've got a portrayal of the Ark of the Covenant, it looks like, which is the Hebrew tradition, Hebrew scriptures. You've got a Mayan-style pyramid. I mean, it looks like a religious Disneyland, that it seems to be a theme park of world thought and world religion. That's a lot of cultural knowledge in one place. Now, I was interested to know, what is the date of that place for that knowledge all to have come together? Does it reflect an ancient global culture, or was this simply put together by someone who is very well traveled? What do you make of it? It's an extraordinary place. What do you make of it?
So there is an interesting story about the Candi Suku Temple, because before I went to Indonesia, I checked with David Childress, and we have all these great temples in these big cities like Yogyakarta. But David Childress is like, no, don't go to these touristic temples. Go to the site called Candi Suku and then tell me what you think, right? Because he has already researched about Candi Suku. So I went to Candi Suku, and it's a very difficult place to reach. It's on a place, it's on kind of like a mountainous area, and the roads are really narrow. So when we went to the Candi Suku temple, our jaws were just dropping on the floor, because this temple in a remote part of Indonesia has a pyramid. Okay, and this pyramid looks very much like the Mayan pyramid of Chichen Itza. Now, the thing is it related to the Mayans? But when we look at the carvings, we look at carvings that are very similar to Hindu carvings as well, because we can see gods like Ganesha there, the elephant god there. So it looks very similar to the Hindu gods as well. And then, more interestingly, like when I started to really look at the carvings, I realized that their heads were not normal. Okay, they had real elongated skulls. And we're not talking about just one or two statues. We're talking about like dozens and dozens of carvings, which really had like elongated skulls. There, you know, there is a lot of controversy about these elongated skulls. Some people say, okay, so they were just doing head binding, because some tribes do head binding and they're able to kind of like modify the skull. But I found one more detail that completely nails this, because these are not humans. They had holes outside of their earlobe. They had one near the temple here, and then they had one behind the earlobe. And we're not talking about one carving. We can see the same detail in all the carvings. These carvings are shown with elongated skulls. And the sculptors, I mean, this is where it's really interesting, right? The sculptors wanted to tell us that this species had this detail that was, that's not present in humans. So, which is why they painstakingly put these holes outside the ears. So this clearly proves that these were not humans. And the carvings show like really interesting details. You can see signs of torture. There was some conflict going between them.
And these beings that you're describing with the reptilian style face, the elongated skull, the hole in the skull above the ear, they are the power people depicted here, and they're in power over the humans. And so the $64,000 question is, are these extraterrestrials? And were they governing over our ancestors in the deep past? Is that the story we're being told?
If you enjoy our content here on Fifth Kind TV, I would like to support our work, please would you consider subscribing to our website, fifthkind.tv. Here we will have our full catalog of material, along with exclusive access to interviews and documentary content. Sign up today, become part of the community, become part of the conversation. Thank you so much for your support, and I'll see you there.
I certainly think so. I certainly think that once upon a time, extraterrestrials came to our planet. And just like what Elon Musk is planning to do, you know, 20 years from now, they came to Earth. And I mean, I just visualized the scenario of what would happen if Elon Musk goes to a distant planet, let's say we call it Planet X, and then there are like cave men living there, right? So Elon Musk will just land in that Planet X. He'll just have everything, right? So if they come to attack him, he'll just use a laser gun and kill them. He can just click the lighter and make fire, right? And the cavemen will just think of him as a god. The cavemen will be like, okay, how is this guy able to just take something out of his pocket and eat it, right? We have to fish and we have to go hunting for like a whole day to find food. How is he able to do it? How is he able to make fire with just clicking his hand? How is he able to just kill a person by just pulling a trigger, right? So to those people, he's going to just look like a god. And this is exactly what I think happened many thousands of years ago. And I think people would have observed these extraterrestrials or gods coming and landing on our planet.
Yes. I mean, that story echoes in ancestral stories all around the world. You can hear it in the ancient Mesopotamian stories. It's buried there in the stories of the Bible. You go to African story in Nigeria, listen to the Yoruba people, the Edo people, the Efik people. They all have a version of this story. And for me, it's the correlations that make me take it really seriously. I think we were visited. I think we were adapted in the deep past. And in some of the other temples you visited, you found stories of that seem to represent people being engineered artificially. We talked about the gestation pod, for instance, that you found in one temple. Is it, yes, a Kumba, it's called?
Yes. It's called a Kumba, yes. Yes, we do. There's a lot of carvings in Hindu temples that show evidences of very advanced, like, medical technology. For example, in many Hindu temples, you will see a sperm swimming towards the egg or ovum, and it's just getting ready to, you know, to go into it, right, and make a zygote and start life. This is a very popular carving, and you can see this in many ancient Hindu temples, more than 1,000 years old, okay? And these carvings should not be there, because we did not invent the microscope until the last 500 years. We're not supposed to see these single cell organisms, right? But we do see them. And we also see cell division. These carvings show step by step how one cell divides into two and then becomes into four. We're literally able to go from pillar to pillar looking at how a single cell transforms into a big organism, okay? And it's really interesting, because why do we see these carvings, right? If we see these carvings in, let's say, Egypt or Greece, we may not be able to understand that fully, but when we look at ancient Indian texts, these texts talk about test tube babies. These texts talk about how in ancient times, they were making babies outside the human body. Okay, this is called Drona. So the test tubes were called something like Dronas, and they could do it outside the body. They could literally do this kind of in vitro fertilization. Today we do this in a petri dish, right? So we take the sperm and the ovum, and then we artificially do it. And this technology was talked about in ancient times. But today we don't have these gestation pods yet. Okay, so typically what happens today is you'll have IVF or in vitro fertilization. And then after, you know, the cell starts, the zygote starts developing to a certain level, you go and put it back into the woman's womb. That's how we do it, right? But ancient Indian texts have taken it like one step further. They talk about a gestation pod that's built completely outside. So the woman doesn't have to do anything. So the baby completely goes inside the, grows inside the gestation pod. And they talk about how to provide nutrition to the fetus. Okay, so you think about that. So they talk about like how we maintain the kumbha. So how are we supposed to maintain the temperature? Like how, what kind of nutrition goes into this kumbha? Okay, now we have not completely achieved this yet. I will bet you in 50 years, let's say 2075, there's going to be a lot of people who are using external gestation pods. A lot of people are not able to hold the baby. They're not, their wombs are not strong enough, and they're all going to move towards these gestation pods. And 100 years from now, a woman who actually delivers a baby naturally is going to, you know, be the headline in newspapers. Because people, even today, even having like a normal delivery, like not doing a C-section, is becoming really rare. So in 50 years and 100 years, people will completely move towards these external gestation pods. And think about it. Is it just a coincidence? Is it just fantasy that ancient Indian texts are mentioning the exact same technology? Absolutely not. I think such kind of technology definitely existed in ancient times. And we have carvings that support this, and we also have texts that support this.
So Praveen, what's the age of the texts that talk about these technologies?
We're talking, for example, the texts of Ramayana, at least 2,000 years old, okay?
And when at they least talk about these technologies, is it your view that it's describing the technology of the gods, so to speak, of the extraterrestrial visitors, or was it human technology at that time that's since been lost?
This is a good question, which I don't know the answer to yet. So part of the confusion is in understanding, okay, which one is a god and which one is a human? Because they, at some point, they become really intertwined. We don't know who is human and who is God. And they talk about a civilization that kind of blends both of them together. And hence, the arrival of Nephilim or giants. In Indian texts, they clearly mention the giants. And what's interesting is that they're always shown as a hybrid between humans and gods.
Exactly. Yes, you find the same in the Bible, in Genesis 6. You find the same in the Sumerian story. Gilgamesh, of course, was a giant. And it is the result of hybridization. And the fact that that story repeats around the world, for me, that's a bit of a smoking gun. But in terms of distinguishing human from gods, there is a kind of entity that gets mentioned around the world that is described in very distinct physical terms as being reptilian and feathered. So you've got the feathered serpents of Mesoamerica. You have feathered serpents in the biblical story. Feathered serpents exist in China. Can you tell me, how do the Sherpa and the Nagas fit into that picture in the world of Hinduism?
There's a lot of material about Sarpa, which is obviously related to the word seraph.
Yes.
And then serpent. And they're all coming from the same root. That's really obvious. They're more commonly known as Nagas in India. And the thing is, these Nagas live underground, according to ancient Hindu texts. These Nagas live in like a subterranean world. And these Nagas are still considered very powerful gods. There's a lot of people who worship these serpentine gods. We have a lot of people who claim that they're descendants of these serpentine gods. A lot of people say, okay, so I'm only partly human. The other part of me, my like my great-great-great-great-grandfather was a Naga. The classic example, we have certain tribes called Nagas in India and Sri Lanka as well, who claim that they're descendants of these Nagas. In Cambodia, if you just go to Wikipedia and see the origin of Cambodian civilization, the very first queen mentioned is actually not human. She's a Naga. She comes from somewhere, and she actually founds that civilization that transforms humanity. So we do have some strong evidence that Nagas were these reptilian beings, very powerful, and they're able to do things like shape-shifting, for example. They're able to transform and create illusions. They're capable of flight, and they usually live underground. And Nagas are also credited with building many megalithic structures. People do worship, a lot of people worship Nagas, especially in South India. It's very common because they believe that the Nagas are listening to us when we're talking. The Nagas are always listening to us, and they can help us if we ask them.
I find it fascinating how strongly that correlates with stories around the world. The origins of the kings, for instance, so many cultures claim that the authority of their kings was derived from the non-human kings who preceded them. That's even built into the story of the British royal family. If you research the Stone of Scone, for instance, the Stone of Destiny. So it's a really universal story. It's fascinating. But there was something else I was going to ask you about that slipped my mind. It might come back to me in a minute. So while I'm waiting to remember that, I'll ask you something else. On a lighter note, if you go to ancient Armenia, lower Mesopotamia, Bolivia, Ecuador, you will find gods wandering around with a handbag. And people speculate as to why they're all carrying this same handbag, what is in it. And what I've heard from you is really interesting, because you found some carvings in India that are not quite handbags, but might give us an insight as to what could have been in the mystery object. What are your thoughts on that, Praveen?
Okay, so, I mean, like you said, you know, we find these handbags in places like Armenia, especially in Sumerian carvings. You always find these gods holding a handbag. There are a couple of places where I've found this handbag in India. And the first one is a place called Gangaikonda Cholapuram. And that handbag is kind of like put up on a tree branch. It's just hanging from a tree branch there. Somehow, the carvings I've seen, I've never seen a handbag placed on the ground, which seems to be very odd to me, okay? Which seems to imply there's some kind of a power source, right? Well, we normally don't put, until the last 30, 40 years ago, we're not allowed to put batteries, like the big, like a car battery, for example. We're not allowed to put it on the ground because it just starts to drain quicker because of the earth. Which makes me wonder if it's some type of a power source. There is another temple called Avriya Temple, which showed more than a couple of handbags. It's very interesting because this temple called the Avriya Temple shows the handbag open. Okay, we can actually see what's inside the handbag. Okay, but again, this is kind of a bummer because inside the handbag, there seems to be like more containers. Okay, there's like two there are like two bottles in there with seem to have the lids intact. There are two bottles, and there's like an arc-like instrument there. So we don't know what they are. Like now we start to move from like what's in the handbag to like what's in the bottle.
Yeah, what's in the jar. Yeah.
Right. So, but they did use the handbags, and it's interesting because they clearly show, right, these guys are shown in the middle of a battlefield.
Okay. That's right. That's right. I'd forgotten that detail.
And that's what's interesting, right? So if you're going into a battlefield, you're not going to be like, okay, I'm just going to take a bottle of like apple juice, right? You won't do that. You're going in there with only the most important stuff, right? Because it's a battlefield, right? You're not going to be like, okay, let me just take like a Snicker bar or like some chocolate bar or something like that. So you're going to take only the important stuff. And he's taking that handbag, and inside that handbag, he has two containers and like an arc-like thing. Of course, that I haven't solved that mystery because now I have to go and look for the carving, see what's inside that jar.
In the jar. All right. Praveen, I will ask you again in another year or so and see if you've found out more on that. People want to know. Now, I want to come back to the spiritual aspect of your quest, because one of the things I love about what you're doing is that it's not information just for information's sake. It's part of a much deeper quest for you. And I know that you've sat and studied at the feet of masters, of siddhas and sadhus, and you've seen some things. And so I want to ask you about that bigger journey you've been making, and ask from all the things you've seen in temples and from sitting at the feet of masters, have your beliefs changed? Have your beliefs about human beings changed, and what's possible for us?
I believe that we haven't fully understood ourselves, and we've just gone like really far away from our initial quest, which is mastery of self, which is reaching enlightenment, which is achieving eternal peace. I think we're moving more and more towards more conflict. People have become more evil. Again, this is all mentioned in ancient texts. This is called the Kali Yuga in ancient Hindu texts, where people start to become more and more evil rather than understand their problems and try to solve them, achieve happiness. And I have gone to like really remote places. I worked with a lot of siddhas or these masters, and they seem to have transcended all these little things. They don't care about all these petty matters. They are quite devoid of anger or fear or, you know, the worries. You know something has happened in the past and it still bogs you down every day, and you're going to carry that for the rest of your life. And these masters don't have any of that. And they're able to achieve this kind of a mental state through meditation. And mostly they live reclusive lives. I do, and this is why you don't see me. Sometimes you'll see I don't make a video for like 2 months. I'm just gone because I'm in a completely remote place where we're not allowed to have cell phones. There'll be no connectivity. And we're doing, we're doing certain rituals to kind of enhance your mental state. So we do a lot of that. A lot of this is also done in secrecy. We're not supposed to talk about this, but we do recreate ancient rituals. The ancient people around the world, not just in India, the ancient people around the world were much, much happier. And they had tranquility. And we somehow seem to have lost all that. I don't think human beings are supposed to have that kind of, this level of conflict. It's just insane, I think. It's good because, I mean, luckily I found, this as my passion, going to the temples, working with all these people who are quite spiritual. So it does bring me a lot of happiness. It's definitely brought me peace. I was able to definitely get rid of all the negative emotions. I don't hold, these silly grudges or like worries and all that stuff. This is definitely brought on by these sites and these people I work with.
Now, a lot of people listening will say, I love the sound of that. And I certainly need to de-stress myself and to move away from heavier emotions, as Plato called them, and get rid of all my wounds and resentments and anguish and unforgiveness. But I have 3 kids to look after. I have a job to maintain. I would love to go away for 2 months and meditate and sit at the feet of a master. But what can I do in my mainstream employed life that can begin to move in the direction that Praveen is describing?
Well, I don't have an answer to that. I should be selfish and say, watch Praveen Mohan channel.
Well, that's good advice. That is good advice.
Yeah. The thing is, what we do a lot of stuff, but it's really intense. A lot of people come to me and say, okay, what are you selling, right? Can you take us on like a spiritual tour for like a week and we'll pay you big bucks? We don't run tours like that. It's a big industry, as you may as well know. A lot of my friends, Hugh Newman, who I met last week, he was in India. He also does tours like that. A lot of this is also connected with spirituality. They'll be sitting together in an ancient temple chanting a mantra, and then they'll go to like a yoga retreat for one day. And it does work. It does de-stress you. But unfortunately, I'm just too dumb for all that. I'm just going to, the thing is, I haven't made any money out of this. I'm just going to the temples, mostly because I don't think, if I wanted to make a ton of money, I would just go back to the United States, It's not a big deal for me, but I think I'm trying to crack the code of what it is. There is still a lot of missing pieces in the puzzle that we're not understanding. I think only in the last 10 years, I've kind of scratched the surface of all these carvings, these texts. But I believe if I do it for another 5 or 10 years, we may be able to make a significant step forward in really understanding what it is.
Yes. Yes. Well, Praveen, I think you're making this journey on a lot of people's behalf, and I'm watching with bated breath as you continue. If I were to save up and be able to come over to India and say, Praveen, take me to the one temple that you think is going to be most mind-blowing for me, where would you take me? What would you show me?
I would take you to this temple, which we only found out last week. This is a temple called Mandagapattu. This is a cave temple. This is the oldest monolithic cave temple built in southern India. This is about 1,400 years ago. The specialty of this temple is that it's built with a negative construction technique. Now, what's a negative construction technique, right? So when we talk about constructing a temple, when we talk about constructing a temple or a house or an office, what do you think about, right? So you start from the ground level and you start adding materials to it, and then you construct the structure. Now, this is the positive construction technique. But this temple at Mandagapattu was built with a negative construction technique, meaning that nothing was added to it to create this temple. There was this giant rock. It looks almost like a giant hill. And then the architect did not add anything, but just started to scoop the granite out of this giant rock. Okay, he must have scooped tons and tons of rocks. And then he, what you're looking at is created because of the removal of materials. And what he's done is very strange. He has not put any statues there. There's nothing inside. The three chambers are completely empty, okay? But there is an inscription that says this temple is dedicated to Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. It does mention three gods, the three main gods of Hinduism, but the chambers are actually empty. So which makes us wonder, are these statues invisible? Because we don't see any sign of destruction there. It doesn't appear that these statues were destroyed. The inscription says there are three statues, but there are no statues there. So it seems very interesting to me because this temple was built with negative construction technique, and then it has these invisible statues in these chambers. And then another really important detail is that the inscription says nothing is added to this, okay? This is a key part of the inscription. But you can see these slots on these chambers for doors, okay? So the doors must have been put there, but according to the inscription, you cannot add anything, right? So that door must have also been like a megalithic door, carved out of the bedrock. It's just mind-boggling to me if that's even possible. Okay, I don't know if you went to like Coral Castle in Florida. Did you?
No, I haven't seen that place.
Okay,
but, you wrote about this, didn't you?
Yeah. I wrote a book about it. It's a good one, and I think we taught there. He built two doors. One was a 9-ton door. Another one was like a 3-ton door. Made out of rock. The 3-ton door still works. If you go to Coral Castle, you can still like move it. Okay. So the 9-ton door doesn't. So because it's kind of jammed. But the thing is, at least we know that that's possible, right? So we can see that that's possible.
Yes.
And we have in a place called Chennakeshava Temple, you can see a rotating pillar. It's a giant pillar. It's a giant pillar weighing tons. And this is a rotating pillar. And now we can see more. There's an entire lingam, which you can rotate in India. And we're talking about ancient temples here. So this kind of building megalithic doors, like movable parts, is like really interesting to me, which makes me wonder if Mandagapattu had this kind of technology, right? They must have had these stone doors, right? Moving stone doors made out of the same rock. So Mandagapattu is a very interesting site. I'll leave some of this kind of unsaid, but it's also like a hanging temple. It's not started from the top and also not started from the bottom. So there are only two ways you can make a monolithic temple. You cannot build it in any other way. So one way is you start from the top of the mountain and you go inside, and this is called cut out rock technology.
Yes.
Okay, this is found in Kailasa Temple in Ellora Caves. This is found in Betuan Kovil in Tamil Nadu. There's one more rock cutting technique where you find a giant rock and you start going like this from the ground level. Okay, then you make it into like a nice temple. Okay, but the Mandagapattu Temple, what's strange is that these guys didn't start from the top, and they also did not start from the bottom. Somehow they started like maybe like 8 feet from the ground level. So how did they even do that, right? Were they like kind of hanging and carving this? Like, we don't understand. And this is an extraordinary temple, which Hugh and I just visited like a week ago.
Wonderful. Well, Praveen, you've got me saving up for that trip. You've whetted my appetite. What kind of are you getting pushback from people in India for the work that you're doing, or is it all encouragement?
We won't. I mean, definitely not, right? If 100% of Indians or 100% of the people around the world were encouraging me, then I'm definitely doing something wrong, right? Right? I should be like selling ice cream or something like that, right? Right?
Course.
I mean, this is actually how I estimate how powerful the content is. If I don't get any criticism for like 6 months, then I actually stop and say, okay, I'm doing something wrong, right?
Yes, yes.
Because
I relate supposed to that.
Yeah.
I can relate to that for sure.
Absolutely, right? So we are going to do that, right? We are all going to face this kind of criticism because the mainstream media, the mainstream narrative, it's so like rampant, and it's also has such deep foundation. So in case of anything, right? So I don't know if you heard of like William Harvey, right? There was this guy called William Harvey. This is a doctor who found out that the heart pumps blood to the human body, right? And he had to go to great lengths to prove this, right? So he found a person who was dying in an accident, and then he had to like cut open the body and show that the heart was pumping out blood. But guess what? All the doctors who lived around his time refused to accept it, right? Because if they accepted it, they had to throw away all the books and all the procedures and everything that they were following until then, right? So whenever we come with something new, you're always going to see a lot of criticism. And then this is exactly what we should be doing, right? We have, like Tony was telling me that, you know, we're talking about UFO stuff. Same thing happened with us when we were doing the UFO stuff in the US. In the US, the great thing is like every town has like a UFO society, and we'd go and be a part of that society. And then we talk about the UFO stuff. And when we posted this UFO materials to places like Facebook, they would delete our content. They would think that, okay, this is a conspiracy theory. This is not real, right? But today, this UFO stuff is considered real. All the governments are starting to accept that, yes, you're, of course, you know, like, I mean, the universe is so large, we can't be the only intelligent life. I mean, that's just common sense. But we had to fight an uphill battle for many decades.
Yes.
So I will. I mean, I hope I get more backlash, but that's just going to happen.
That's how it goes.
Same thing with UFO, right? But what? But people like Bob Lazar, you know what happened to him? They just thought he was crazy. When he was talking about UFOs, they just laughed at him, right? But today, people have accepted, yeah, I mean, he was right. And he was just like way ahead of his time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So Praveen, it's 2024. What does this year hold for you? What are you up to? And how can people keep up with your work?
I have a bunch of temples that I have to go to. We're focusing in India and we're focusing in Southeast Asia. We're going to a bunch of different temples. We're trying to find the true history of these ancient builders, like what were they trying to do and stuff like that. So I have at least about 20 to 30 different temples that I have to visit and research in India and Southeast Asia. And that's basically it. So, I mean, this is the part where Paul is asking me, like, what are you selling, Praveen? Are you selling a book? Or are you selling, like, a meditation course? Are you selling, like, tours? Like, Praveen Mohan is just too dumb to do all that. So I'm just basically putting out all the materials I find online. It's just 100% free for you. If you just search for my name, Praveen Mohan, you can find me on YouTube. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Instagram. You'll find all my videos, all my pictures just thrown out for free. You can just support me by just simply giving me a like, subscribe. More importantly, if it helps you, if it inspires you to do your own research, that would be fantastic. Because what we do need, like what's the need of the hour, is just more people with open minds. Like we don't want people who are like really dogmatic. We want people with an open mind just coming out and saying, okay, let's just explore this area. Let's just try to understand our past much better, right? So according to scientists, what Homo sapiens start, what, like 200,000 years ago or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And we only have documented history of like 5,000 years. So, yes. So that's like, that's the percentage, right? So of history that we know about. So there is a huge portion that we don't know anything about. So if we just get more people rallying up for this cause, that'll be awesome. Hopefully, man, I shape up and I write a book or something next year. So I feel embarrassed to tell you that I got nothing to sell.
That's wonderful. Praveen, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. I think that's a great note to conclude on. It's been a pleasure. I hope you'll join us again sometime. But thank you today for joining us on The Fifth Kind.
Oh, pleasure is all mine, man. I had a great conversation. I hope that your viewers also like this content, appreciate it. It was an absolute pleasure. I mean, this is the first time we're talking to each other, and I feel like I've known you for a long time. So thanks a lot.
I feel the same. The feeling is absolutely mutual. Thank you.
Yeah, all the best. Pleasure. All right. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.